The Local Thread.
Welcome to La Prensa Habla. This is Jessica Molina, and I am here with...
your favorite co-host.
My favorite one. Yeah. Don't tell Kevin.
Chaz Bose from Compassionate Calvary and La Prensa.
Yes, we're here with Linda. Linda's sitting in the guest seat today. So how are you doing, Linda?
Good. This is going to be quite different and quite exciting because I'm sitting here with my son and we're going to talk about parenting. So this is really going to be a very neat, different experience for me.
We're going to talk about parenting today, and we brought Belinda Covarrubias here because not only does she have her own parenting journey, but she is kind of like the community voice for a large group of our parents here in Toledo. So how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Thanks for coming on. You know, earlier we were talking, Chaz, that this is the most important job. But then I'm like, ooh, I can't say that in front of Chaz because I think there is another most important job that we have. Chaz is like, what is it? What is it?
Yeah, I don't know, but I was excited about being on. And then I heard that we were talking about parenting, and I'm like, parenting? And you called me? Mm-hmm. Because I just don't think that I'm probably the best parent, but who does?
I mean, everybody exactly. Probably.
If you're not a little insecure about your parenting, then maybe you're probably overly confident. And who likes overly confident people anyway? It's good to stay humble and always realize that you always have something to learn. Nobody yes. has all of the answers. And it's okay to make mistakes as a parent. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I practice regularly is asking my kids for forgiveness, telling them, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Because I think it gives them the opportunity to realize they're free to make mistakes as well. Nobody's perfect. We're all learning. And so that type kind of takes some of the pressure off.
Absolutely, yeah. It does.
Yeah, I've always told everybody that there is no manual. You're not given a parenting manual when you have a child. And not every child's the same. So even if you were, how would you? You know, everybody's learning and everybody's, you know, just growing through the experience.
I will say recently I took a class, which we can get into a little bit more deeper in the second segment. I'm excited to share that with you. But before we dig into the topic, Belinda, we have to learn more about you. I mean, everyone around here knows you pretty well, but for the listeners at home, can you share your story with us, maybe a little bit about your upbringing, and then how it is that you're a community voice advocate now?
Okay. My name is Belinda Covarrubias. I am currently the hub director for El Centro Hub. And what we do is provide services to families in the Old South End and Latino families in Toledo, Ohio as well. I work there under Sofia Quintero Arts and Cultural Center and then also in the school in the neighborhood as well. This work is very personal for me, and I was thinking about this before, like, the podcast, because I'll talk about Lourdes Santiago and how she helped my family. She's an integral part of why I'm here right now, but I remember Lourdes always reaching out to me, inviting me to community meetings, inviting me to come, like, you know, trying to get me involved.
She's a persistent one, that one,
yes,
isn't she?
She is.
Love her.
Mentor to many.
Yes.
Years and years, and I wasn't ready, you know, but I was just thinking about that the other day, and it's just, I guess, full circle because, you know, here I am now. But to kind of share about, like, my background and then how I guess Lourdes fits into that, I am the daughter of immigrant parents, I'm Mexican, and my parents were both born in Mexico. My family is from central Mexico, so Irapuato, Guanajuato.
Guanajuato, yeah. Donde la vida no vale nada.
And my background's interesting. My father and all of my uncles were coyotes. So for those who may not know what that is those are the people, even now, who bring people over the border.
Mm-hmm. They're the reason Baltimore got stuck here in, what do you say, the Fremont area?
Yeah, you might hear all types of things about coyotes, to be honest. I mean, some people are going to say they're unsavory characters. I don't know, but that's just what my dad did. And he actually brought my mother over to the United States, and my mom was pregnant with my oldest sister, heavily pregnant, ready to pop. And they wanted their children to be born in the United States. So just imagine my mom crossing the Rio Grande, very pregnant with my dad.
And we mean literally crossing the Rio.
Crossing the Rio. Through, absolutely, yes.
Do you know where they cross, though? Like, no. Which area they cross? That would be interesting to know.
That would be interesting to know. Unfortunately, my dad, he passed away in 2014, but some of my uncles, I'm going to have to, like, reach out to them and find out, because
those are the most interesting things. And then to go back to that spot and kind of, like, reimagine the sacrifice that your family made to come over, it was so scary for them. It's a whole new world, cultural shock, PTSD. I mean, nobody even talks about the mental health and the trauma of people that came up north.
It is PTSD, seriously, and we need support for our families that have gone through that. Like, we could go on and on about that, but that is specific. We need support groups for that because it's a very unique experience. And I would imagine, unless you've lived it, there's no way you could ever understand. I can't understand. Right. And so that's where we settled. No, that's how we settled in Texas and in the Valley. And so then my parents would come to Fremont, Ohio. Like, we would go back and forth doing pepino and tomato. So my parents separated in Fremont. We were in the migrant camp. And I mean, even now, I don't believe that they're suitable to live in the wintertime. But especially back then, you were not going to be able to live in a migrant camp in the winter. Mm-hmm. And so my dad returned to the Valley. And so my mom's in Fremont in the migrant camp, no English, undocumented, with three young children. I was the youngest at the time, and that is where Lourdes found us.
I was going to say, cue Lourdes Santiago.
Yeah.
Well, Lourdes and her partner, Martha, were working in the migrant camps at this time, doing education and helping out.
And so I always wondered, I need to talk to Lourdes, too, because I want to hear from her perspective, because I've never asked her. But yes, so they connected with my mom, and they are the ones who helped us come to Toledo. So we were at the YWCA. And I mean, it just kind of goes from there. You know, my mom is so strong. I think about everything that she had to navigate. And, you know, for me to even be here is just a huge testament to her strength, for her to be able to do so much. And not alone, like, with, you know, help from the community, from Lourdes, from Martha. I'm sure
she's so proud of you and where you are and what you've become.
I believe so. I grew up. I will say that, you know, growing up, I was the child who was always helping my mom. I was the child who was going to appointments. I was the child who was always translating. I did my mom's taxes and all of her friends' taxes. That might be illegal. I don't know if I get in trouble for that. But I remember doing everybody's taxes.
As long
taxes.
As they didn't pay you, and it's not child labor.
Okay. So we're good, you guys.
As long as you did it for free.
So we are okay. I just remember always being there with my mom and just helping her, you know, with everything. And that's why the work is so important to me, because not just the strength in my mother, but the intelligence, because it takes a lot to navigate everything that she navigated. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, me going with my mom and going into appointments, even just at McDonald's, ordering food or wherever, sometimes seeing the way that she was treated because of the language barrier, that has always sat with me, because it's the thing is, the intelligence, the strength, the resilience to make it through so much and to still be here standing, mm-hmm. and to have your children grow and be successful, it speaks to so much. But because of the language barrier, people weren't always able to see that, or they judged her. So mm-hmm. that's something that has always sat with me, and that is really important to me in the work, you know, that I do. And another one is my oldest sister. Spanish is my first language, but I mean, for the most part, I remember speaking both languages. My mom was always very big on speak Spanish. We speak mm-hmm. Spanish, which was a big difference for what the culture was in Toledo at the time when I was a child. It was not encouraged to speak Spanish.
So you grew up here in Toledo then?
Yes. From the age 6 on up, we were here. Yeah.
In the old South End?
Yes, in the old South End. Mm-hmm. And, well, I lived in the North for a little bit, but mostly in the old South End. Like, I went to Jones, I went to Libby, so yeah. But my oldest sister, Meli, she will have like more experiences than us. And so she had to learn English. And so when she was in school, she had a moment where she needed to use the bathroom. And they would not allow her to speak Spanish at school. Mm. This was in Fremont. Mm. And she ended up going on herself because they would not let her go to the restroom because she couldn't ask it in English. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's something else that I have just always remembered. It just sits with me. And
how did your mom navigate that? Because last week we talked about Latinos in education, and one of the things that we were talking about then was we give so much grace to authority, right? It's mm-hmm. like if the teacher says something, the parents listen and the kid better listen.
Yeah.
So do you remember mm-hmm. how your mom navigated that situation?
I don't remember, but I would imagine that it wasn't navigated, to be honest. I would imagine that it just happened and we just kept going on. Mm-hmm. And you're right, that is something culturally that exists, and we don't have to live like that anymore. We don't have to put up with that anymore.
Well, so. My grandmother was from Laredo, Texas, and we never dealt with that, and I never had to handle that. So
yeah.
I think there are some differences, because there are some Chicanas, some Latinas that had not had that same thought process. Yeah. And so definitely my grandmother would have went to that school and let them have it.
Yes.
Yep. Let them have it. And still do. And then she'd call my mom and they'd have
she would let them
the
have
whole
it.
Family.
We have a whole meeting now. My mom was...
I'm learning a lot about your family right now.
My mom was one of those that was, we're going to meet about it. If I got in trouble with other kids and stuff, it was, we're calling their parents over to our house. We're having a meeting about this. It was always, we're meeting about something.
But I think the key is knowing English. And I think what you're saying is your mom didn't really have a grasp on the English language. So she probably felt really lost and really devastated, and... You know, what else do? You just feel powerless.
Yeah. And she wasn't documented either. So there was a whole nother level, you know,
so
a layer on top.
And you're away from your extended family. You know, my mother spent lots of years depressed. It was cold. It's cold. You're not with your family. Spent a lot of time going back and forth, too, between family over there and over here. And
so that's why I'm depressed, because it's so cold, huh? It is cold!
But it was important for my mother that we retained our culture and our language. Yeah. And we knew where we came from all the time, and that we passed that on. So it was very important for me. My mother, though, to me, always seemed more like that next generation, because we didn't cross the border crossed us. So we've been here for a while. Mm-hmm. And so she's that next generation that believes in education and on parenting by the book. Mm-hmm. You know, what does the book say? How do you parent? That was my mother, like, kind of a lot in our generation does that with our kids now. Like, mm-hmm. we want to raise our children differently.
Yes.
And we look at these books and we read all these things on how you should do it. And I always feel like that's the way my mother was.
I've thought about it, too, just like in reflection before this episode. I feel like I was in a situation similar to Belinda. And it's like my parents were surviving, right? That was the name of the game. It was survival. It was provide. And there wasn't much beyond that. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean like that was the challenge that they had. And now I feel like it's our responsibility to thrive. You know, mm-hmm. they survived and they provided. And now it's on us to thrive mm-hmm. and to parent in a different way mm-hmm. because we have so much more than what they were given.
Yeah. And because of their sacrifices. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like my daughter, she tells me, my 5-year-old, she says, Dad, I don't like Mexican food. And we go to this restaurant in Ypsilanti and try it out. And she goes home. She goes, Dad, I don't ever want to go to another Mexican restaurant. I don't like Mexican food. I'm thinking, what's wrong with you? And, I mean, she said, I just like chicken nuggets. And I'm thinking, you would have starved in my house growing up. Because every day I'd come home from school, my grandpa would have fresh beans made. Fresh tostadas made, whatever the meal was that day. But he cooked. My grandmother didn't cook. It was my grandfather who cooked. So I grew up with a very strong feminist household. Yeah. And so.
But you now understand why I don't.
Yeah.
Good job, Linda.
Hence, Ray was here today with a dish.
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be in another segment. Your husband's going to cook.
Yes. He cooks. He's the cook in the house. Yep. Not me.
So, like you're saying, parenting different. That. Mm-hmm. If I would have told my grandparents growing up, I do not like Mexican food, they would have looked at me and said, well, then I guess you're going to starve.
Yes.
Yeah. Because that's what we eat. But no, we just go to McDonald's and say, okay.
I think about that, too, just like the difference. And I think about my parents' life before they crossed the river. My dad also crossed the Rio Grande. And I think, mm-hmm. like, you know, what was his life like versus my, I had to have been such like a selfish, Americanized little child in their eyes, but
spoiled.
We don't know any different, you know, mm-hmm. but there's such a cultural difference between the generations.
Yeah.
Well, I think our parents and grandparents and that other generation, the older generation, they lived to serve us.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
we kind
so
of don't live to serve our kids. It's like
speak for yourself.
It's like
Chaz.
I'm a parent. Well, I'm speaking for a lot of people that I know.
He's the
everybody
apple.
I know.
Chaz is the apple from this tree. So I can relate.
Yeah, it's like I mean we're raising you and loving you and supporting you, but yeah. My grandparents they lived for their kids. Like mm-hmm. their whole life was about their kids.
Yes, they did.
And so it's like I think now. We want to raise them well, but we want to have our own lives too and enjoy our own lives and don't make our life all about our kids so that when they turn 18, we're not having a mental crisis saying, what are we going to do? Because we lost
That's
our identity.
So
we don't know what to do because our kids are 18. So I think
But I think there's different types of parenting because I do have some friends that their whole life is their grandchildren or their children. And then mm-hmm. you have like me who I was raised where no we're all about you. And I said, oh, okay, I like that life. I think I'll keep taking it, even if I have children. We can all still be about me.
So. Oh, my gosh. Well, we'll dig into this a little bit deeper in the next segment because I think there's a lot to unravel here. So we'll be back after this short break.
Back to La Prensa Habla. Well, we're back, but we lost someone and gained someone else. Linda, my mom, had to leave us, but she'll be joining in the third segment. But we're just so excited to have Nalix Ortero, who's doing such an amazing job and such amazing work in our community. When I saw her walk in, I had to do a wellness check and just make sure she's all right because she just works so tirelessly and so hard in the community. Now, Nalix, you want to tell us a little bit about you and introduce yourself to our viewers?
Sure. Nalix Otero. I am first generation born Puerto Rican heritage. I am originally from Chicago, Illinois. I moved here in 1996. Both of my oldest children are born in Chicago. My youngest daughter is Toledo, so she's a Glass City girl. Don't tell her that. She doesn't like that. she wants to be like her sisters. I started my journey in community work probably around 2004. I am a graduated Adelante kid, so I did work for Adelante. I worked for NHA, Job and Family Service. So I've worked for a lot of various agencies in the community. So I'm back at it.
And then you're like an amazing cook. And don't you have a food truck as well?
I do. I do have a food trailer.
All right.
But
don't sell yourself short.
Yeah, I do have a food trailer. I'm currently in the process of looking for an actual standalone restaurant. So
nice. That's
my goal for 2026 is to bring Puerto Rican cuisine to the Toledo area.
And we love Puerto Rican cuisine.
Yes, we do love that.
It's fattening, though.
That's okay. That's okay. We're no one's counting calories here.
Cuisine is not fattening. I don't think any of it is good for you. But I appreciate the invite, and I hope that.
Well, I keep telling myself pasteles are healthy because they're like all verduras.
They are healthy, but the achote is not healthy.
That's our word of the day.
Yeah, achote.
Stop it. That's our word of the day. What? We'll have to talk about that more next segment. But
seeds.
Exactly. Nellie, now you wear many hats, but we have you here today and Belinda here today because you are community voice advocates for a large group of parents in Toledo. And so we were talking a little bit about how our parents make sacrifices for their children. Do you see that in the community, both of you? I guess I'll start with Belinda and then we'll go over to Naleigh. Do you see sacrifices, commitments made on behalf of the families?
Yes, absolutely. Our families, they do so much for the children. I see families walking miles to make sure that their children are making it to school. Mm-hmm. And so one case in particular, there was a parent who was walking 2 hours each way. So that means they were waking up, getting their child ready for school, walking, dropping them off, walking mm-hmm. back home, sleeping, and then waking up and doing it again.
Wow.
You see that a lot. You see that a lot. Like, education is so important, and the parents want to make sure that their children are, receiving the education that they should have. And so mm-hmm. there's a lot of sacrifices that go into that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they do sacrifice a lot. Education, as far as, holding more than one job, a lot of our families, the dad works probably the PM shift, mom works AM shift, but mom works overnight AM. So she comes home from work I think that they sacrifice a lot more because they're not only sacrificing their physical health, they're mm-hmm. also trying to gauge where they're at emotionally. Like, my child is being, basically thrown into a multicultural, like, American culture and Latino culture is way different the way that our parents bring us. Mm-hmm. I've sat in many trainings and been asked, like, do you feel like you grew up in an impoverished household? And I think, like, I literally have to sit there and think, like, I had the best childhood ever. Like, I was so rich in love and so rich in community and so rich in, being taught the right things and what to say and what not to say and how to be proper, that money was never like a topic that I ever heard my parents talk about. So if my parents were ever sinking in the hole financially, we never knew it. I went to a magnet school. I graduated from Lane Tech, which is a magnet high school in Chicago. I was top 12 in my graduating class.
Wow.
So I grew up in a house full of emotional and loving support. My parents' marriage was probably not the greatest in some points, but mm-hmm. I can't judge them as a married couple. I can only judge them as parents. But I see a lot of our families sacrifice, and they worry that they can't compete with the Joneses. Like, they can't
provide
they can't provide the type of lifestyle that the other kids that are second, third, fourth generation Latinos mm-hmm. are here, because they're more acclimated. So I think part of that too is they're sacrificing a lot of their upbringing style because they have to contour to American style upbringing, parenting, mm-hmm. and they also have to make their household work around the lifestyle that they are trying to bring to their kids.
Yeah.
Because their kids have a lifestyle 10 times better. And the kids don't see it that way. The kids
I
have to go to Walmart to get stuff. We don't go to the mall, but maybe once a month. But mm-hmm. in our reality, you're growing up in the richest environment ever because your parents are mm-hmm. so worried about you in every aspect. Whereas other families, they're just feeding and financing, but they're not emotionally in tune with their children. Yes.
There's so much pride, though. I remember from my time at the school where, yes, the sacrifices are happening, the struggle is there, but there's so much pride. Do you see that show up at the school, Belinda?
Oh, my goodness, yes. We, when we have, like, awards programs, award ceremonies for honor roll, we do in around November a family potluck. We have all different types of celebrations, and the support is just huge. The families show up, and it's not just the families, it's, you know, primos, tios, tias, like everybody shows up. The children come in, you know, in their dresses.
Sunday best.
Yes. It's just adorable to see. And that, again, that's that pride and that cultura, you know, that speaks a lot to the families. But I can easily say that the school has the support. We get more families than other schools do for those types of things. Like the parent support, they're so involved.
Now, do you see our parents, do you ever see them struggle with navigating systems? And if so, how do they overcome that?
Ooh, navigation of systems is always a struggle. It's a struggle for anybody. I think, honestly, we're in a stage in life where if you don't know somebody that's going to actually connect you or walk you through the process of things, you don't want to even try to attempt to reach out to services. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, you can have someone like me advocate for you, but there comes a point in time where I want to teach you, empower you to advocate for yourself by giving you those tools to navigate that. But unfortunately, we do also live in a city where we might have someone in a position that looks like us but doesn't speak our language. So therefore, that's also a turnoff. Because, you know, I remember when I first came here from Chicago, I was sitting on the board working for Robert Wood Johnson, working with SCHIP when they first integrated that program into Medicaid in 2011. And there was a beautiful young woman, her last name was Flores. And I walked over and I was like, hola, ¿cómo está? And she's like, girl, stop it right there. Because this last name is just pretty. Because none of what you just said I understood. And in my mind, I was like, what do you mean that you're Latina and you don't speak Spanish? When I grew up in a city where it's like either you know it or you're not going to talk to anybody. So it's the culture shock from coming from a city that embraces their Latino cultures, all of them, because I come from a melting pot, to coming to a city that's like, don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Or don't speak your language. And I'm like, why? I'm loud and proud. But it's just, you know, getting used to that. And even now, 30 years later, we're still there. Yeah. We're still where families are not going back to XYZ agency or ABC agency because of that. When we accomplish that cultural competence, we're going to lack somewhere else.
We need to close the language barriers.
Absolutely.
We need to be welcoming to the human who is in front of us, regardless of their accent or their perceived background.
Right. That's something I can say that El Centro Hub, that is a big thing that we advocate for and work. And I can say that I have had the opportunity and the privilege to work with a lot of providers who are open to learning, you know, how to provide services in an appropriate bicultural, bilingual way. And so, yes, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, a lot. It takes time.
Yeah, no, and I think, too, you can have... And I agree with Belinda. There are providers that are willing to help, but how quickly does that transition come down to the people in the front line? Because I can be a top dog. I can be an executive director or somebody that supervises a bunch of individuals in a department. But if I'm not trickling down that, like, is a as of right now type thing, if I'm sending them the message, like, whenever you feel like it, or whenever it works for you. No, it has to be like, listen, we have individuals that come in here that may not dominate English as well as you do. So you need to ensure that that person walks out of here feeling like someone that speaks English all the way. So, you know, we provide English as a second language classes for free 3 times a week through our agency, through my program. But it doesn't help if that person can't go into your agency and speak that broken English, because I grew up with a mom that used to say map instead of mop. But mapping meant mopping. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So growing up in a household where your mommy talkie like this all the time, you know, I couldn't make fun. I mean, we made fun of her because she was our mother. But when we went out in public, yeah, because we wanted her to say it the right way.
Yeah.
But I realized that she didn't care to say it the right way. She said it the way that she said it because that's what made her feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I am not who to tell my mom to try to develop an English accent, even though.
But you understood, didn't you?
Sure did, because the chancla was coming. Let me just tell you.
But you did know, you understand me?
I understood her loud and clear, you know? And also having a mom that wanted us to teach her English, but a dad that said English in his household was not allowed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my mom learned English based on disco. Like this lady played, you know, Gloria Gaynor. She played, you know, Casey and this. She played all that, and that's how she learned. And my dad was like, "Oh, she just likes disco," and I'm thinking like, "No, she's learning English." You know,
yeah,
so it's just that. It's just it, as long as we have those individuals that understand that there's a need for cultural competency, but that has to be disseminated. It has to be something that everybody on your team understands and embraces.
And that's such, even like within a family, you're talking about everybody on your team as far as the system goes, but we've just talked about different examples where different people in the family have different ideas about how to approach the culture that we live in now. And so it's so unique. We were talking earlier about how our parents maybe came from a lens of surviving, and now we have the ability to thrive because they survived. I mentioned taking a class, a parenting class. Now, one of my friends was trying to earn a certification, and so she needed like a test dummy to go through the process with her. And I thought parenting class, like there's no job is more important than parenting. So I took this parenting class. And I'm curious what you think about this. Now, the approach was about the nervous system. So imagine that you're talking to your kids. The approach is, instead of reacting to what they're saying, you're actually reading their body to see what their nervous system is doing. And then you interact with that. So what do you guys think? It's so out there. It's different than how we were raised. And so I'm curious of what you think about it.
I think co-regulation is real. So I guess the way that I interpret what you're saying is, if my son is having a difficult time, big feelings, I have to meet him. I observe his body. What is his body telling me? And regulate myself so that, you know, our nervous systems will speak to each other and then he can calm down. So I guess just addressing the emotional aspects of it.
Alex is struggling with this over there.
Validating his emotions, because however you feel is real. If you feel scared, angry, however you feel right now, it's real.
Yeah.
So I validate your feelings. But then let's talk about this once he's settled. I guess that's how I approach parenting. It's very different than how I grew up.
Yes.
And I think that's why I do it, because I want my son to have a voice, because, and we talked about it a little bit, about how what happened with my sister, how, you know, no action was taken, and it's just because my mom was surviving. But, you know, I would have absolutely handled that different, but I've had a different experience growing up from my mom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she did the best that she could at that time. But that's why I think my parenting philosophy is sort of, I'm a total gentle parent.
Oh. Yeah, I'm the total. No, I'm not the total opposite. I'm a psychologically driven parenter. I'm a step facilitator, so I can, you know, do a parenting class through the step program. And when I went to Boston to learn that, and let me just say this, my children are 32, 30, and 26. Mm-hmm. So I was parenting in the 90s and the early 2000s. So, and I was a 17-year-old mom. So my parenting was really a teenager trying to grow up with her kids. And so my kids became like whatever was important to me, I poured into my children. right? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't a disciplinarian like my dad was, but I was a psychological disciplinarian. And you want to come back at me, I'm not going to throw the chancla, but I'm going to take away something that you like. Or I'm going to sit you down and we're going to, you know, body language. I'm an eye roller, Puerto Rican. What can I say? Talk with my hands, talk with my shoulders, talk with my eyes. So body language, when my parents saw my body language, it was over with, you know? So my kids grew up different. I'm a grandma of seven. So my grandma skills are like yours. I read their body language. Yes. Because I care about how they feel. I don't care about their mama's feelings. And that's, I know I always tell my kids that, you know, like I was growing up with you guys. And so I apologize to my children every time because it's like, I didn't do that for you as a child, but I'm going to do it for my grandchildren. But yeah, my parenting style was a little bit of my mom and a little bit of myself and a little bit of whatever I saw on TV at the time. Like I think that I fared very well with my children. Yes. You know, I got lucky and I was blessed with great kids. And they're, you know, come from a broken home, divorced. So I did okay. But I mean, if I were to go back and do it again, I would have waited until I was a little bit older. But teenage mom is different for us when we're raising kids.
Yeah. I love that grandma philosophy that you're saying, that you like, you can approach your grandchildren so much differently. I've noticed that with so many different grandchildren parent dynamics or grandchildren grandparent dynamics. And I think if I can do this, if I have the ability to treat my grandchildren like this, I better treat my son like this now. I'm not going to skip this generation. I'm going to give my son the best that I can, just as I would give my grandchildren. And it sounds, going back to your upbringing, Chaz,
it all roads lead back to Chaz.
Yes, they do. But you had strong grandparents, and it seems like that had a really good effect on you too.
I did, and part of what I wonder is, we're spending so much time and energy turning our wheels so that we can do everything so different than the way we were raised. But I think some things, I think you toss out the bad and you keep the good.
That's true.
Because y'all turned out pretty well, regardless of anything you went through, y'all turned out great. So I think that there's a lot that we can take with us so we don't lose everything. And there's some things that definitely we can leave in the 80s and 90s and 70s and wherever else we were raised.
Every generation gets better, right?
Yeah. And I really think you mentioned it, and then Chaz, you mentioned it earlier too, just apologizing to your children. I also have a 26-year-old who I was a 17-year-old mom, and he's had a different experience than my youngest child. And I apologize to both of them, but my oldest, we've had some intense conversations, and I have just told him, listen, I made the best decisions with the information I had at that time. It doesn't take away from what you experienced, also. I've just apologized for it. So I think, acknowledging and apologizing, that's one thing I've learned. Trauma is created by how you respond to a situation, not necessarily by the situation.
Well, I want to apologize to all the people listening and let you know that we're going to the next segment and you won't be able to taste the food. You'll just have to be able to hear about it. So I want to apologize to all of you that won't be able to taste.
Yes. So we'll meet you in the third segment where we get to taste that food and we talk about our word of the day.
Welcome back, everybody. My favorite segment is this third segment, and I really wish everybody could actually be here because you could smell how wonderful this next segment is going to be. We have wonderful guests today, and I'm excited that everybody's here. I am Linda Alvarado Adse.
I'm Jessica Molina, and we have Belinda Covarrubias here and also Roman Arce. And Roman, you made the food today, so can you explain to us what we have here?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you so much for letting me, you know, try to do this. In recent years, I've been cooking more, and one of our favorite destinations, you know, me and Linda, is to go to Mexico, to the Yucatan Peninsula, Cancun area, and Isla Mujeres, which is a little island, you know, near Cancun. Mm-hmm. And in going down there, they sell this, you know, and I've got to learn about cochinita pibil. And, you know, I didn't know at all what that was. But then I learned that it's a very traditional cooking method. It uses a distinctive spice called achiote or achiote.
Achiote, that's our word of the day today.
Okay, yeah, well, that's great. And I didn't know what it was until a few years ago when we were in Mexico. And then...
what is it?
So it's a spice made from anato seeds. Mm-hmm. So anato is a tree common to the Amazon basin, South America and Central America. The seeds are shiny and kind of an orange red. So the in the indigenous language, the seeds are called achotol, meaning shiny seed.
Mm.
And then in Spanish, achote. But the achote is actually a paste. So they grind up the seeds. You end up with a paste that is, when it's all together, kind of like a brick-looking thing. And I'm going to give a shout-out to one of our friends down there, Julio Maldonado, down on Isla Mujeres. He gave me a big brick of this spice. Wow. Because I'm interested. He knows I like to cook. And so little by little, I've been, cooking in different versions of this. In the traditional Yucatan way of cooking it, pibil refers to the way they cook it, which is wood, and they make a grill, but in the ground. So you actually cook the meat wrapped in banana leaves in a hole in the ground, and it cooks at a low heat for hours and hours. Here, we're in the middle of winter, so this is coming out as cooked in the oven. So, cooked in the oven, you cook it for like 5 hours, and it takes, quite a few seasoning and different kinds of peppers and onions and tomatoes. And anyway,
It smells very lemony, citrusy. Is there citrus?
So very common down there. And they do this whether they're making fish, and they also use the achiote, that same spice. But everything starts out with a combination of three different kinds of citrus. So you squeeze lemons, limes, and grapefruit, or I don't know, whatever you can get your hands on, orange, lemon, lime, grapefruit, and everything ends up, with the spices mixed in with that. You also have to blister the garlic and the peppers. So you don't just put them in green. You actually, so there's a whole process. And so I really like doing it. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, let's see. Let's dig in. Let's take. All right. Is it do you have tortillas here?
Yep,
are we making little
got
tacos
some corn
for
tortillas.
Everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure do.
It looks delicious.
Oh, and another thing that's traditional for this dish is, and it's distinctive with the spices that they use, is pickled onions. So you pickle red onions. Again, very traditional, to put on your taco if you like. And they're right over there.
Do you want some pickled onions, Melinda?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I'm going to go grab some.
It looks amazing.
Yeah.
I see bay leaves, too.
Yep, lots of bay leaves.
So lots of spices go into this.
Yeah, I see lots of peppers.
Oh, yeah.
And what got you interested in even cooking? Because you're actually an attorney. You're La Prensa's attorney.
I don't know. I get older, and it's kind of been something I've done since I've gotten older. And I take pride in it, and I like when people, enjoy what I make.
Is it something that you had ever when you were growing up?
This food?
Yes.
No. So my family, is from south of Texas, and the food is your typical that I'm accustomed to and growing up, like my mother's cooking, south Texas, north of Mexico cooking. The spices and everything here
Norteño.
Are different. No, they're definitely far different.
Yep.
Yep. I've seen that seasoning, achiote, is used a lot in Mexico, Puerto Rico, Cuban, Dominican, Central American countries. So it definitely has its indigenous roots is what you were saying, right, Roman?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so Mayan.
Yep.
So in the Yucatan, they talk about it as a traditional Mayan, dish.
Mm-hmm.
So in different parts of Mexico, regions of Mexico, they identify more with different indigenous groups.
Mm-hmm.
So other parts of Mexico might identify more as having an Aztec heritage.
Mm-hmm.
All those indigenous folks, though, did use the spice. Mm-hmm. This particular is the Yucatan Peninsula, so Mayan, and they're very proud of that. So if you go to Cancun, you go to that whole area, they have a lot of monuments and ruins. And statues, but it's all about the Mayan culture.
Yeah. I've actually, the very first time I came across that spice was in Ecuador. Ecuador uses it as well. They have a soup where they will put that into a soup. It's like a potato chicken soup. And they will put that spice in there. A lot of any of the Latin American countries that have that a bigger, large indigenous population will use that spice often.
So here are some uses that you might not know. It's the original food dye. So before artificial food dyes came in, this was the original.
That's before henna?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
You could use
I don't
henna
know.
Too.
That's true.
It has a strong color, though.
Yeah. It does have that really deep red color. Mm-hmm. It's been used as natural body paint.
Mm-hmm. Insect repellent.
Wow.
The indigenous people use it as insect repellent and in their rituals to paint their bodies with the orange-red color.
What do you think, Belinda? How is it?
It's really good.
Oh, my gosh. So you said 5 hours you were cooking this?
Yep, wow. But you prepped it, too. It took hours to prep. This is like a consuming dish to make.
It was very time-consuming?
Well,
I'm not a big cook, so it seems very time-consuming.
You're like, why are you still cooking that?
I know. Glad my husband cooks.
So you have to do it the day before because the big pork shoulder, you have to get it marinated. But to do it right, you know, you can't expect to do it all in one day. So the day before you want to cook the dish, you got to prepare the marinade, coat the meat thoroughly with the marinade, let it sit in the marinade until the next day. And then it's the next day, you put it in the oven, and then the cooking time is 5 hours at 300 degrees, depending on the size of the pork. I mean, you know, it won't take that long, but that's a pretty big piece of pork, and that has a little bit of bone to it. So that's why 5 hours.
I love that clay pan or dish that you have, too. That seems very authentic, very. yeah. And you do a lot of your cooking with clay, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I do. I use a lot of clay. We use a lot of cast iron, a lot of copper. Yep. No aluminum.
What's the benefit of clay? I mean, aside from that, it's not aluminum.
Well, you know, in our Latino culture, we've always used a lot of clay. One, it's accessible. It's around us. You know, it comes from our ground. But and there's been a push to not to always get that kind of clay anymore or bring it over because it has iron in it. So I'm not saying to use it all the time, but you can find some now without the iron, and they started making it like that. But it's good because when you use the clay and you're trying to boil or like make our beans or something in it, the clay actually soaks up some of that excess water and it makes it thicker, your broth. Mm. It makes it more like gravy-ish than if you didn't do that because you're also having almost like an exchange with the air that goes in it. Sometimes Ray will cook with the tagine. And it does something similar to that, too. It's this, like, pyramid-looking dish that comes, like, Turkish people will use the tagine. And what other groups? Some other groups will use that.
Moroccan cooking.
The Moroccans, yep. Mm-hmm. And that does similar to the same thing. It cooks thoroughly all the food, but it does it almost like a convex or a, I don't know, what those double broiler kind of things. Something similar to that. But, yep, we try to stay as traditional as we can when we make things. Yeah. And Ray is of Mexican descent, too.
Do you have any plans to cook it in the ground, like, when you go?
So I don't know if I'll ever get to cook it in the ground.
Yeah.
But definitely want to cook it on the grill. So that's the other way. And today, you know, if you go into the Yucatan, everybody's cooking it on a grill for the most part. Mm. I mean, they've got these giant grills outdoors and stuff. But the when you wrap them in the banana leaves, that also, you know, you wrap the pork in the banana leaf. That also takes it in another flavor kind of direction. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely going to do that, do it on the grill.
Yeah,
haven't done it yet, but...
The banana leaves give it almost a smoked kind of taste, almost like they did the pasteles that we had the other day, the Puerto Rican pasteles, or Colombians, their tamales. Other people, they'll put the banana, but when you eat it, even their masa has a little bit more of a smokier, different taste to it because of the banana leaves, versus where Ray was talking before, where his family is more norteño, more in the middle of the center, the northern part of Mexico, where we use more corn tortillas. It's mm-hmm. very rare that you see people use the banana leaves over there mm-hmm. for cooking. But as we started traveling and we started going to Cancun and Isla, we started seeing more of banana use, more plantains, more mm-hmm. of the other, you know, Caribbean tropical food items that you never would see, like in Monterrey, in Saltillo, in Nuevo Laredo, where we're from. Yeah. You know.
My family is in Irapuato, Guanajuato, and you wouldn't see it there either, honestly.
Oh, really?
Like, I only knew achiote to be Puerto Rican. I always considered it to be a Puerto Rican spice,
really?
Honestly. Yeah.
Oh,
this is delicious. I can taste the citrus. Is that what you marinated in?
Oh, yeah. It's got a lot of citrus. Both the, you know, both the pickled onions and the...
And it's tender. Is that what makes it so tender?
Yeah. That, well, there's a lot of stuff on it.
That and the time. So,
and the hours that it cooks.
Now, it looks like there's stuff in there. Like, are there peppers in there?
Yeah. So once you have the meat marinated, you know, ideally you have it marinate overnight. Then before you put it in the oven, you layer on top fresh sliced onion, fresh sliced tomato, and some sliced up red peppers, orange peppers. You know, not the green ones. I actually prefer, this was my idea, I put a poblano. So in addition to a sweet pepper, you know, the poblanos have some heat to them. But that I slice up and add on top. You know, this is right before it goes in the oven with the onion and the tomato. And again, I added the poblano as a pepper that I like the spice in the poblano in addition to the yellow or the orange pepper that have the sweetness, or red pepper, whatever, one of the sweet peppers. But that's a final step. And that's when the bay leaves go on top, too. So you coat it pretty heavy with bay leaves, too. And then in the oven. And then you really don't have to mess with it. You know, it's pretty much 5 hours and it's done.
Right. Well, it looks delicious.
It smells wonderful. It smells wonderful.
Did you try some before coming here, Linda?
No, I did not. I did not. I will eat some, though, when I'm done here. I'm going to definitely eat some. I'm hungry. And it smells great.
And I have one more question, Ray. How much achiote do you have left?
Oh, a lot of that brick?
Yeah.
Ooh. I've got 90% of it, probably, you know. Mm-hmm. Our last trip to Isla Mujeres was in August. And so, you know, yeah. I've got and I knew it when he gave it to me because the thing was heavy. And, of course, at the airport... You know, at each airport, they wanted to know, what is that? So I had to pull it
out. What's that brick?
You know, coming back from Mexico with a brick.
With a brick.
But they were, you know, they were fine with it, you know. But yeah, they did have to inspect it, and it was something that clearly set off the airport folks.
Right.
But, you know, all thanks to those dudes down there, you know, the friends we have down there in Isla Mujeres. And then, you know, they're kind of impressed with me that I actually, you know, cook with it. You know? They're like, you don't even know what you're doing. And so, but I follow directions, you know, I get recipe off the internet. And this is probably my fourth or fifth attempt at it. So I think this one came out pretty good.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We like to ask our guests, like, what does this food remind you of? And I know, Ray, this reminds you of vacation. But Belinda, is this dish similar to anything that you've eaten or you used to eat as a child?
It tastes very different, honestly, than the food that I'm used to eating as a child, just because my mom, we're, like, my family is traditionally from Irapuato, Guanajuato, and so I think the food is very different. I think it's more similar to what you're saying you're familiar with, but my sister makes, I can't think of what it is, it's tostadas, and it has a lot of, it's really spicy, chipotle in it, and then it's shredded, it looks like it, but it doesn't taste like
it. It's a pork dish.
Yes, it's a pork dish. But no, this is very different. It's delicious, though. But it's nice, like, I don't think that I'm very familiar with, like, the Yucatan at all. It's just interesting how, like, depending on where you are in Mexico, the food can be so different.
Yep. I remember the first time that we went to the Yucatan, we were like, oh, wow, what do we order? This food is so different. And lots of seafood, and we weren't used to seeing so much seafood either on the menu.
So.
And then grilled with, you know, like all these different spices, and we were like, whoa, what do we order? You know, how do we get around this? It's very different. And we noticed that in a lot of different countries that we go to.
Yeah.
We're like, huh, don't know what that is, but we're always experimenting with different foods.
The other thing.
Oh, tinga is what it is, too.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like tinga to me.
Okay. Yep. But I like the seafood dishes with that same spice, the achocha, which are very common down there. Mm-hmm. The thing is, it's a challenge to get seafood worthy. You know, down there, good seafood is so common. Yeah. And a lot of times we're catching and cooking fish that we had just caught, you know, ourselves with these guides that take us fishing. And then they use that same, you know, spice with some onions and some peppers. And man,
right on the beach.
Right on
They'll
the beach.
Cook it right on the beach, terrific. Right on the grills, yeah. right there for yeah. you. Yeah.
So I try to do that when I get the seafood that, you know, that'll give it justice. I try mm-hmm. to cook that as well.
Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you, Ray.
Thank
for
you.
Bringing the food. Thank you, Belinda. Thank you all for being here, for listening to us. And until our next episode, join us again for La Prensa Habla.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.